My name is Laurent Ferry, and I'm the acting director of the French Studies Program. It is indeed our great, great pleasure to have Hélène Cixous with us. This is not her first visit to Cornell, but this is her first time here in her capacity as Eduard Professor at Large. She was appointed last year, and as you know, this is the greatest honor this university can possibly bestow upon an individual. Do not worry, I will not speak long for three reasons. The first is that I don't want to make any blunder, and I think we already created enough embarrassment with the official communique announcing the appointment, which portrayed her as, I quote, an intellectual of towering proportions. The second is that Hélène Cixous is a human being of too many parts to be reduced to a few words. In 2003, Jacques Derrida wrote a text entitled Genesis, Genealogies, Genres, and Genius on the occasion of the spectacular donation by Hélène of the entirety of the manuscripts to the French National Library. And in this brilliant essay, Jacques Derrida stressed the challenge of defining, and this is another quote, the genius of every literary genre and of the university without condition that she is. Finally, I will not speak long because you have all come to listen to her, not me. I just need to thank again the numerous faculty members for their endorsing Cixous after Professor Ferrand Dubois and I proposed her name 2 years ago. Former Provost B.D. Martin, Provost Ken Fox, the Professors at Large Program and its administrator, Kenny Nichols, the French Studies Program, especially our assistant, Caroline Ferraris-Besseau, Cornell Cast for recording the event. Last but not least, I'd like to say thank you very much to our guest speakers at the conference. They came from Barcelona, Leeds, Los Angeles, and Paris, and we had a wonderful time. Students will have an opportunity to meet with Hélène and join an informal discussion with her tomorrow in this very same building, 236 Goldwyn Smith, from 5 to 6:30. Without further delay, please join me in welcoming Hélène Cixous.
Thank you all and each. Thank you, my very dear Laurent Dubreuil, Laurent Ferry. Thank you all of Cornell, my Cornell friends and allies, in the fight to defend the survival of humanities. Although I'm going to talk of humanity today, not exactly of humanities. Thank you, Penny Dietrich, who has rescued me from the volcano and carried me over to our appointment of today. And of course, my heartfelt thanks to Peggy Kamuf, a great reader and a gifted, giving, wonderful poetical translator, and keeper of our secret archives, who gives such a new life to all my texts. And it's so new that I can myself enjoy reading my own texts as they return to me in a new language. But let me introduce you to one of the main characters in the cast of the paper I'm going to read to you, and that's Jean Jaurès. I know I wouldn't do that in France, because Jean Jaurès is one of our most moving heroes in history, but I know that probably many of you have only heard imperceptibly of this person. Jean Jaurès, let me write his name. Beautiful person who was, in a way, the ancestor or first incarnation of Jacques Derrida, to whom I wish to dedicate this this paper. Jean Jaurès was a young teacher of philosophy. You know that this is a French specialty. And he was born in 1859 in the south of France. And he was converted to socialism. Again, a word which for us in France has no threatening reverberation. But he was born in a time when at the time of the invention of communism. And you know that that was the great dream of mankind. And communism went along, pushed forward into our times by Marx, with a crop of or dozens of different socialisms and anarchisms. And this was a beautiful period when everybody had a right to dream and hope, even though all the hopes were mad, as hopes are. Jaurès was converted into being the main eloquent orator of French socialism, because he taught in a small city, which was a working city, where one in Carmaux, where one used to there were big factories of glasswork, and the workers went on strike for many, many, many weeks. And it did somehow help Jaurès to discover the working condition, that is, at the end of the 19th century. So you have to make an effort of imagination and go back to times when you weren't yet at all in any field of existence. And it was a beautiful time. So the paper is, there's the title of Volleys of Humanity, and you can translate volleys in every way you can. We human beings, we have inherited magic words which we do not wish to touch for fear of causing their shimmering wings to lose a little of their dust, of their dazzling dust. We have inherited, for instance, from distant words, Latin words, justice, humanity, or from a Greek cousin, democracy. And this inheritance accompanies us, sends us messages, glistening incitements. We're enchanted. Are they allegories? And then all these ravishing words are feminine in our French gendered language. Surreptitiously added to the charm is a pinch of difference, of sexual difference, a sexual dusting, a slight exaltation. By virtue of what are we human? By virtue of what do we say that we are human? By the fact that we read, for instance, words humanity. We're reading in the morning, as soon as it is day, we read from the cradle, from the first gaze, we already want to belong to a gaze and fall under a gaze. Already we are reading. We're giving ourselves to read and be read. We're making links. We're mirroring ourselves in the mirror of the other. Is this the beginning of being human? We are reading whom and what? We are reading someone who reads us. Quote, what we are doing when we read Jaurès Jacques Derrida said to us a couple of years ago. And the moment he says that I'm listening and reading carefully what he says, I note already he has constituted with two words a community to which we who say we are invited. It is the community of we who read Jaurès. So please come into the community. Or someone equal to Jaurès, an equivalent. The name Jaurès standing for an exemplary representative of any being to be ready, to be read. I continue reading Jacques Derrida, reading Jaurès. Quote, on the works of those who are no more. That is, naturally, any work for to read is always to read in the absence of the author, adds Jacques Derrida. To which I add that to write is likewise to write in the absence of the author. I continue quoting, is thus, as one will have sensed, to enter into a living, dead, absent-present relation, a spectral relation with a presumed signatory or signatories, or the presumed signatory scene of this text. Now note, one has to understand clearly this living-dead relation, living and dead, already dead and yet living, present as absent. This is what the scene of reading grants to whoever engages in it, communications that shake up the presumed oppositions or contraries. We speak to them, says Jacques Derrida, we listen to them. When we read, we are in dialogue with Jaurès. We connect ourselves with Jacques Derrida, Jacques Derrida with Jaurès, we with Jacques Derrida with Jaurès. List, list, listen to me, says Jaurès, says Jacques Derrida. I listen. Jacques Derrida says, I have written, like others, under the gaze of Jaurès. I have wondered, says Jacques Derrida, is Jaurès there watching us? And also, given the chance and miracle of the homonymy, is he there at l'humanité and watching to see if people are behaving well and so forth? Now, l'humanité, let me write that. L'Humanité actually is the title of a daily in France, which for us French reading and speaking people is quite familiar. We were born with L'Humanité. We were born with the daily L'Humanité. That paper was founded in 1904 and by friends of Jaurès, Jaurès being the director of this paper, which was the first communist paper, the first socialist paper. And for the first issue, the first copy of L'Humanité on April the 18th, 1904, Jaurès wrote a large head paper saying this. L'Humanité, I want to keep the word in French, if you allow me. L'humanité doesn't exist yet, or if it does exist, then it exists only à peine, only almost very little, and à peine with pain and difficulty. L'humanité still does not exist. L'humanité in French, and that's the big difference between our languages, humanité is the word that we use both for the virtue or quality called humanity and for mankind. So when Jaurès starts addressing the reading public with this remark, he says at the same time that mankind almost doesn't exist. It will exist later. And humanity almost doesn't exist. It will exist, but later in the future. And L'Humanité, the newspaper called L'Humanité, doesn't exist except with this new trembling, newborn paper. Audacious and pathetic and critical remark has been commented by Derrida, because you can imagine what it means to print at, let's say, 50,000 copies, a paper proclaiming that we don't exist. We still have to come to existence. And but at the same time, Jaurès, the author of this declaration, the declaration of humanity to come, was rather hopeful. He simply promised his reading public that humanity was to come, and it would come, not as Messiah, but very rapidly, thanks to socialism. So when Derrida says, is he there, Jaurès, at L'Humanité, that means in that small room where the editors of L'Humanité were working, is he there and at L'Humanité, maybe, and watching to see if people are behaving well and so forth? He cannot be avoided, says Jacques Derrida. I listen to every word of this confidential philosophical observation, and I see the scene, which is succulent and moving. I recognize Jacques Derrida reading in his manner, the manner of any genius, which is to slip back into childhood, to go sit in the classroom where a sublime teacher's lessons are radiating, with the soul of the pupil who we are awakened to the other's word. And naturally, I say to myself, surely he's there, Jacques Derrida, at L'Humanité, and he's watching to see if people are behaving as he would himself like to behave, as well as possible, in the most just and exacting way possible. But in this television of Jacques Derrida, the word humanité, humanity, does not refer only to Jaurès's L'Humanité, I mean the newspaper with that magnificent name, but to the humanity of Jaurès and Jacques Derrida, the one they have in common, and about which the one and the other, the one and later the other, invite us first to reflect and second to dream. Is he there at humanity? Hello? Have you seen him up there? And with that, we find ourselves in the midst of literature, groping our way as in a dream. We knock at the door. Is that he there who is glowing, sitting down perhaps, keeping watch at humanity, at the hotel of humanity, or else standing to the right of humanity, which seems to us indecisive and dazzled as we are, destinies that we are and that we do not control, to be immense and majestic, like a woman people, L'Humanité, a feminine word, a kind of Jerusalem, seen in Kinevision by William Blake. And in the next scene, here we are going up to the counter of L'Humanité to ask if he is indeed there. We desire to obtain a ticket for humanity. We do not know exactly what we're asking for, but our desire knows. We continue to be pupils and teachers when we are curious and want to know more about humanity. We gather in the same supertemporal lecture hall all our ignorance and all our experience. I should say, like Blake, the chorus of our innocence and our experience. This spectral evocation opens us, extends me to you, to us. Every thinker, every being who sets out to think, even if it's not a profession, is in this great classroom and feels humble and vast, small and large, surrounded by souls or spirits, or, Jacques Derrida would say, spectral presences, burning to ask questions, to ask the questions, ours. Kafka is in the back corner up there with Abram, and he wonders who is going to save, who is going to betray whom. There are many silences in the plural. There are silences for listening. Here is Stendhal up there, who stands up. How he has always made me laugh, that one. He's fresh and full of energy, like a rose with a bumblebee. He's just seen Nap, as he calls him, Napoleon, form. And he's going to pose his questions to the one he has chosen for himself as the jurist respondent, for respondence is rich, and to whomever one addresses oneself, whoever one elects, whoever one reads, has something to teach us, for he or she is the master of our enigma. And Stendhal's master is Montesquieu, the French philosopher, who has died a long time before, but we're still there. Sir, says Henri Stendhal, master, what must I think of myself in the end? Was I a witty man or a fool? A brave man or a fearful one? Was I a coward? I have always had the idea of writing my leaf, he writes in his bad English in the text. To tell the truth, I have had it many times since 1832, but I was always discouraged by the dreadful difficulty of the je, the I's, and me's, which will make one sick of the author. I do not feel I have the talent to get around it. To tell the truth, I'm not at all sure I have the talent to make people read me, says Stendhal. I sometimes find great pleasure in writing, that is all. If there is another world, without fail, I will go up to see Montesquieu. And if he says to me, my poor friend, you've had no talent at all, I will be cross, but not at all surprised. We do not have just one master, Spectre, whom we ask to evaluate us, to do our portrait, to do his own, to give us the advice that we give ourselves or do not give ourselves. We have more than one, naturally, more than one wise man, more than one just woman, and always it is someone before whom we bow and we hope to be raised up. It is the best, the most tenderly strict part of ourselves. Thus, Jacques Derrida tells us, I wrote under the gaze of Jaurès. Now you know under whose gaze he wrote. He says this when he expresses himself in the space of political problems. He trusts Jaurès. Among men concerned with rethinking politics and the political, for the love of the beauty of the history of this man Jaurès, a professor of philosophy, a resister, an eloquent speaker, and surely for the love of the use of the French language. True, it was not Jaurès who proposed the title L'Humanité for the newspaper that is so named. It was actually a man of l'École Normale Supérieure called Lucien Herr, a Jew, by the way, and a philosopher. It's important to say that. But it was Jaurès who blessed and incarnated it. The title, the newspaper, the organ, the aim, the drama. Humanity, as Jaurès, was assassinated on July the 31st, 1914, and next day the war broke. He was sitting, that is Humanité Jaurès, in a coffee shop, discussing with friends and telling them, we're not going to have war. There won't be war. And somebody shot him in the back. But this given title, is the stroke of a master of writing. Note here, I would tell you that I'm writing this exactly on August the 12th, my sheet of paper between two cats here, with one cat here and one cat there. A thing I could say to Jacques Derrida, who knew them, I write between the two cats and with the two cats. I'm a cat being. humanimal being. And I wonder if Jaurès was an animal person. I'm looking. Surely there was an animal. It is well known that Stendhal did everything in order to be also a horse. The presence of both cats, at once on the two sides of my sheet, is highly unusual. I attribute it to the substance of what I'm putting down on paper. The point is to turn around the words of Jacques Derrida. It is impossible not to admit that what you think you have is not yet at your disposal, that is humanity, in a sufficiently determining or sufficiently decidable way. You're not yet in a position to determine the very figure of humanity, which nonetheless you're announcing and promising yourself. Every word counts. I come back to the word humanity. That one word, as you know, is worth 6 billion words in mankind. And I come back to the amazement we feel at the idea that l'humanité, the word, thanks to the call launched by Jaurès and his friends, has become this symbolic place that some have dared to let humanity speak rather than take its speech away and to give themselves to humanity without knowing where he, the newspaper, or she, life, would go. Is he there at l'humanité, plays Jacques Derrida, and watching to see if people are behaving well? All of this is a treasure in French. It is crazy what humanity says to me. Humanité is an abstraction, like freedom, like liberté. It's abstract and still otherwise. For humanité is also very concrete. Humanité does not mean only that moral quality, which is somewhat suspect, moreover, in its homocentrism, that's why I need the cats around, of concern for others. It also refers to a people, to the people, mankind, the people of human peoples. It is this French word, caressed by the poets. It is not the mankind, used in English, which says the human species, not only. As for humanity, we would like to have invented it, we who seek the most beautiful titles. To name a newspaper L'Humanité, what a formidable rhetorical and symbolic operation. The ingenious thing is the reverse synecdoche, not the part for the whole, but the whole for the part. No one can escape it. And thereupon Jacques Derrida raises the stakes with his figure. I mean, with this figure, that is in any case the word figure in French. Already the word figure, is a syllepsis. This figure is a figure, especially in French. I'm dreaming around all these figures. We who in French synecdochically say une figure for a face. And this we do even in a very concrete, familiar moment, sometimes a little too much, too familiar, compared to va te laver la figure, go wash your figure, that is, go wash your face. Face, visage, becomes noble. What face would the very figure of humanity have? In the word figure, as in the word humanity, the height of abstraction and the height of the concrete are conjoined. And it is Jacques Derrida, more than Jaurès, who will have gotten the greatest effect from it. But let us return to the scene of Jacques Derrida's sentence. Is Jaurès there? Is he there at l'humanité, like a saint on the balcony of heaven? Jacques Derrida slipped everything into this sentence, comically and celestially, in a scene where one glimpses a spectral tribunal, an ethical tribunal. Note, when I read the sentence, he is watching to see if people are behaving well, my two cats stopped behaving well and started as against what Derrida hoped, a new war. Here's the war starting again. In this struggle, I read a response to Jaurès and to Jacques Derrida. There is no natural peace. There has to be a peacekeeping force. Peace is slumbering war. We are animals whose soul is tainted, as the Sufis would say, tainted with a mixture of hospitality and hostility, with hospitality and thus hostility, or as Jacques Derrida says, hospitality. I say to you, yes, yes, up to the point at which I say to you, no! Under the Gaze of Jaurès is the title, the other title of this lecture. It is not simply a figure, not a simple figure. A figure, a face, with or without face, keeps us. We put ourselves into its keeping. This is for me one of the most secret and decisive ways in which to show ourselves human. That is a gaze to which, says Jacques Derrida, we submit ourselves and that we subject to our interrogations. And he says it very forcefully, thus, I was wondering if he would agree with what I said about his promise. I could not make him say things with which he would not agree. In a certain way, I was listening to him in the sense in which one obeys, one listens and obeys. And at the same time, I was talking to him and I brought toward him all sorts of problems. In effect, I was making myself into the interpreter of our age. I was asking him, for example, what would you, Mr. Jaurès, have thought about the concept of crime against humanity? It is a very problematic concept. It constitutes, I think, a positive effect, etc., etc. So what would you say, Mr. Jaurès? To be at humanity is to enter into a consultation, into a spectral relation, says Jacques Derrida, for he insists on the living-dead relation that he writes in two words and that I write in one single word. With a friend, even if the friend seems no longer to speak to us, viva voce, one continues to converse with Jaurès, with Derrida, for the friend is always internal. The human being lodges the friend. We are inhabited, haunted. We listen. The internal friend listens to us think before we have ventured to speak. We shelter, we share the same psychic space. On the one hand, everything we think is online internally. On the other hand, we receive the work of those who have preceded us in experience. And the sublime supplementary twist in the order of time is that we who come later, we bring problems toward our watching predecessors. We climb up and down the ladder of time. We telephone those who have gone before, and we inform them of problems whose formulation was unknown to them. Thus, Jacques Derrida informs Jaurès about the worldwide political displacement brought about by the invention of the internet. The speeds of communication have changed everything, but not so much. Internal communication has always been ultra-rapid and uninterrupted. La Boétie, always responded instantly to Montaigne's thought. There is no cutoff between souls. Nevertheless, the problems have to do with their philosophical formulation, their denomination. They are even created by the formulations. For example, Jacques Derrida has his reasons for asking Jaurès, what would you, Mr. Jaurès, have thought of the concept of crime against humanity? He does not ask what Jaurès or Dostoevsky would have thought of the crime, but indeed of the juridical category that Caesar's qualifies as a universalizable concept, inscribes some act in the codes of international law. What is new is not the crime, the massacre, people tore eyes, out in Cain Lear, raped, cut off hands and the tongue in Titus Andronicus. Questioning Jaurès about this concept, Jacques Derrida is impelled by the desire, the difficulty, the necessity of bringing about a more human humanity, of increasing the human of the human, in that equally undecidable sphere where, when we dream of the thing called justice, we can have the right only to write, or rights, and where too often rights, human rights, for example, ordered as they are by an outdated rigid rationality, overdetermined by the state of constitutions, cultures, philosophical thoughts and unthoughts, being restricted, conditioned and half-blind, create a shield or a substitute for justice whose figure, like that of humanity, sparkles like an uncertain star in the distance. What would you have thought? Jacques Derrida asks Jaurès, or else in another scene, it is Kant wandering before the portrait of Rousseau hanging in his drawing room. This approach to spectres, this appeal, this interrogation from a distance, what purpose do they serve? It is our way of displacing the apparent excommunication pronounced by the verdict, by the death sentence, while re-establishing communication. I bring new problems toward him, and he in turn brings toward me his force of problematization. Thereupon, we need their opinion and their agreement. I wondered if he would agree with what I said about his promise. Not that I want him to agree with me, but I do not want to betray his thought. And the only way not to betray is to remain open to indecision, to the possibility of a disagreement. I need, I hope for the agreement. I solicit the counter-signature of the absent author, who is half of me, but this must remain in the state of hope. The essential thing is that I recognize in me the watching presence, where accompanied and watched over by humanity, the one that is not yet discovered, and to which we devote our dreams and our explorations. I dedicate the coming page to Jaurès, who is not a living dead man like everyone else, he who on April the 18th, 1904, launched that appeal that was so promising, therefore so human, would say the Nietzsche of the genealogy of morals, for whom man is a promising animal, ein Tier, das versprechen darf, as Jacques Derrida recalls in his Humanities. Man promises. As soon as there is human being, ça promet. Ça promet, an idiomatic form in French, it promises, is exactly as the cats, it promises threateningly. There is the question, which is that it and not me promises, or at least me, Jaurès, I promise, and I will be faithful for my part to my promise, but that commits only me, and I do not know what it, all of it, will do, all the rest, all the contrary forces. Nevertheless, this surprise held in store by the promise can manifest itself positively or negatively. Yes, no, we do not know what the future will make of us. Ourselves, we do not owe. Twelfth Night. This is the chance of history. Macbeth might have turned around. This depends on a telephone call from humanity. One cannot say of a man that he will have been happy until his last minute, Montaigne reminds us, and conversely. Humanity is subject to contrary meanings, but not like a weather vane. Our efforts are never in vain, but they are incalculable and subject to time, to duration, to innumerable overdeterminations. Our destinies are ruled by coup de théâtre. Life, like death, does not happen where and when we expect them. How endlessly surprising is the conversion of the cruel Edmund Gloucester in King Lear. He who has tortured and massacred everyone. He ends saying, I pant for life. Some good I mean to do, despite of mine own nature. Quickly, send the brief in it to the castle, for my writ is on the life of Lear and on Cordelia. As if, for example, Edmund, the unnatural son of Gloucester, had heard at the last moment a call from humanity to reunite with himself in a human whole. As if he had been contaminated in the last moments of his history by this other possibility of himself, which is Edgar, the possibility of a love without cruelty and of filial friendship. If I quote the Shakespeare world in front of Jaurès, it is because I wonder if he, Jaurès, did not feel himself watched by Shakespeare. My hypothesis is that, any more than Marx did, he did not neglect the infinite experience of the most canny of geniuses, but that in the dialogue with Shakespeare, he claimed to keep the advantage by choosing hope and the future, whereas Shakespeare shows us humanity in the present. I feel a tender emotion as I follow Jaurès' steps because he sought to push back the hatred that courses through human ranks. He was, without knowing it, without wanting to know it, one of the most beautiful of Shakespeare's characters. He who knew that once he entrusted socialism with the mission of reconciliation with oneself, he was making himself the target of an assassination threat, and who was not afraid, even as he trembled, and remained alert to stand as human up to the extreme end. In other words, up to the sacrifice, and a sacrifice without God, a sacrifice to humanity, which is not yet human enough, so as to make it, by his example, a little more human. Here's a man who was not unaware that failure haunted his promise, but to promise is to enter into tragedy. A man? Each time Shakespeare bestows on a character the honor or dignity of being a man, which is to say a man worthy of that name, a man who illustrates humanity as good, he does so by using the past tense, the preterite, as if honor, rightful honor, did not happen to men in his lifetime. This was a man. These are the last words, the salute to Brutus by Antony in Julius Caesar on behalf of nature. As if one could not decide on this dignity, on being worthy of the name of human, until the last day. So common are our daily temptations, indignity, corruption, cruelty, calculation. If I'm here telephoning Shakespeare, the master in humanities in the plural, it is because he set his whole work around the confused borders where, in the uncertain interweaving of the incarnations of humankind, the appearances of living beings are seen to waver and fall so often to the monster side, sometimes to remain forever in the depths of evil, sometimes, after having sojourned there, to come up at the last minute, as if recovered, but too late, to the charms of goodness. I am thinking of you, signatories of life in 1914. Often I feel that I write under your gaze, that stunned gaze, frightened by the great madness that seized the humanity of 1914. I imagine the immense, vain efforts to keep the sphere that turns round itself on its back like a suicidal scarab. One wants to save, and one does not save. One sees coming, and one does not see. Jaurès sees death coming, and he does not avoid it. Why have I found myself so often before this case? I know why. I seek to put my gaze near that of Proust, for example, who in 1914 finds himself dying of an autoimmune attack under the gaze of all his fellow men, young friends and brothers who are dying, mowed down on an external front. To him, the men dying in his bedroom with a cork wall, falls the task of setting up dozens of telephone lines with death's new subscribers. He must bear up under and think the false survival, the false reprieve, the suspension of incorporation, he who every week incorporates his dear dead ones. And so, as to let you hear the bell, his death knell and his doorbell upon entry into writing of the specters, I choose a certain letter where a bitter remark upon about humanity slips in. And this is the letter of Proust. Alas, he says, the last letter from Rinaldo, that's Rinaldo Hahn, the composer who was his friend, this last letter is so sad that I regret even more his not wanting to take a leave. Rinaldo Hahn had been called to the front. He says he cannot and he does not want to. But I believe he does not want to. And this is the opposite of the rest of humanity, whose habit, when it wants to make others believe it can do anything it wants, is to say, I didn't want to, when I was not able. But, and I do not say this only for him, I don't even say it as much for him as for others, the dead are living so much in me that to be unable to find them on earth seems to me a kind of nonsense, and my state of mind is a little that of a madman. While they are falling, he says to himself, I write. I fall, I write, I fall and entomb. I invent the outer life, the one I call the true life. I am one of those who write under the gaze of different figures of death. That this has been decided for me, I know some of the reasons, but not all. When one meets premature and violent death, one cannot avoid asking oneself, what is the very small, very brief human being, what one would be without the incessant weaving of links with this flux of life which carries us off and surpasses us, humanity. We're so temporary. I think of my brief grandfather, Michael Klein, who died a German sergeant at age 36 in 1916 on the front in Belorussia, for ideas that were morally very great and that would all turn out historically false. I don't know under whose gaze he signed up, a volunteer as a German Jew or the father of family, but perhaps it was under the gaze of Captain Dreyfus as much as under the gaze of the Kaiser, before whom he wanted to defend a Jewish citizen's loyalty. The poor man, he wants to prove that one can be Jewish and no less a good German, and even, oh horror, a better one. No, said his wife, my grandmother, and especially later my mother, to be a good human is not to be a good German or a good Frenchman. And if my mother, who was always first a European, had been able to read the initial issue of Humanity, she would have subscribed to the rightful hope of seeing every nation reconciled with itself to become only a parcel of humanity. I say hope. To hope is not to believe. It is to push incredulity further away. In any case, Sergeant Klein quickly proved that he was a good mortal like all poor men. We think and we pass. Fortunately, there is humanity to carry on. To come back to 1914 and to that moment when everything is internally divided, when socialism is tearing itself apart, is torn apart, thereby imitating nations, where humanity perforce prey on itself, as Shakespeare announces in King Lear, like monsters of the deep, where it turns round on its own parcels, where it is the reason of the strongest that believes it is the best, and where every people proclaims itself the best, believing itself to be the strongest, in that year, 1914, humanity, the one that Jaurès called for in Our Aim in April 1904, took on the figure of monsters of the deep, the leviathans of Hobbes, the behemoths of Blake. Humanity disfigures and devours itself. Well, in that time, there were a few beings who struggled so that this humanity would turn less fanatical faces toward the future. I admire these stubborn giants who stand up without hope and without despair in the face of what I call the last extremity. And in each case, this point of resistance is absolutely concrete. When Jaurès is struggling like a titan under the weight of the war advancing on the universe with open jaws, here is Shackleton, Sir Ernest Shackleton, a fabulous character, who decides to go to the edge of the beyond where no human being has ever yet been. Shackleton, you know, was the captain of the ship Endurance. I will let this figure take shape, the one who pushed back the limits of human endurance and geography by rolling out the monstrous ice floes of Antarctica, a stronger Ulysses, and a more purified Christopher Columbus. Our aim for Shackleton is an idea, the synonym of endurance, survival. The survival of the surpasser that Shelley chanted in The Triumph of Life and that Jacques Derrida picked up and re-enchanted while working on The Superexcitation of Life, romantic survival with Blanchot's survival that is other. One must slip between life and death while breaking up the glaciers on the way to the open water beyond the beyond. You notice I constantly incite the poets to sing. Poetic geniuses, I would say, if that were not redundant, for genius is poetic, because genius is a seer. Shackleton, the captain, or Jaurès, Shelley or Derrida, the child Proust, Rimbaud, they see further. They are seers of the not yet seen, designers of the to come, invokers of the still unthinkable. Just so is Derrida describing not the figure of the future, but its threshold, the step beyond the beyond. The step beyond the known, beyond the here, thus the blank space of the suspended ground, the order that is other, the moment of the step, the moment in which I step into action, in which I act, is a moment that is heterogeneous to the space of knowledge, science, theory, the moment of a leap in relation to the space of knowledge. The leaper, beyond, is a thief of fire who 17 years count for 70. At 7 years, a prophet of journeys, of discovery, for which we have no accounts, of revolutions in customs, of displacements of races and continents, of republics without scandals, of tamed wars of religion, of impossible todays becoming the next enchantments, of states without tea parties. It had been remarked that Rimbaud substituted in his letter to Domeny, a war before that of Jaurès, an antonomasis for the name of Prometheus, not in order to evict the fine name of Prometheus, but to cause fabulous descendants to be born to the first martyr of humanity, the branch of the thieves of fire. It is a way of inviting us to a Prometheization of sight, so as to arrive blindly, as a seer, therefore, at the unknown through leaps and bounds. To bound, bondir in French, what a word. To see words and life through the gaze of another, to make a noun of a verb. To Jaurès, to Derrida, to humanity, that is to say, to make or do humanity, like Augustine saying to make or do the truth. To Rimbaud, Rimbaud dire. I resume. So our poet is really a thief of fire. He has the charge of humanity, of animals even. The future has already begun. When will it arrive? Even Rimbaud advances by zigzags, sometimes bounding ahead of the triumphant future. It arrives when the future, in a moment. Poetry will no longer rhythm action, it will be in advance. These poets will be, when the infinite bondage of woman, that's Rimbaud, when she lives for herself and by herself, men, abominable up until now, having dismissed her, she will be a poet as well. Woman will find the unknown, says Rimbaud. Her worlds of ideas will differ from ours. She will find strange, unfathomable, repulsive, delicious things, we'll take them, we'll comprehend them. The poet would define the quantity of unknown awakening in the universal soul in his time. He would give more than the formula of his thought, than the notation of its march toward progress, enormity becoming norm, absorbed by all. He would be truly a proliferator of progress. So to be human, humanly, would be to be charged with humanity, humans, and animals, proliferating oneself while exceeding one's limits, moving out in front and anticipating us. It would be, or it will be. We will see. Look, here's another poet whose breath I hear. Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp. That's Robert Browning. I pick up and relaunch the English word should because it reminds me of a duty and a debt that are dear to my heart. Should, you know, is that word missing from French that has so many values and virtues, especially in English, although it gets half of them from the Germanic. Here is the very auxiliary of humanity. This should enjoins, firmly suggests, obliges, reminds us that we must, we owe, that is, that we are indebted, schuldig in German, advises us to honor the debt. What does it mean to honor the debt? It is not to pay it so as to erase it, but to recognize, accept it, acquit it while keeping it, while keeping oneself indebted. To rejoice, even to be oneself honored by the debt, that is, taken up in the alliance that makes of humanity a set of links that do not alienate, but weave the living fabrics of memory. I meet up here with an immense field of philosophical meditation, where from debt to debt is thought a sort of debt without debt, contracted before any contract, an advance debt, an advance under debt, an originary liability, would say Jacques Derrida, as always already debt, where call and respond to each other, beyond Nietzsche, Heidegger, then Levinas, Lacan, beyond whom advance, overtaken at the same time, forerunners, Charles Malamud, who introduces us to the debt from India, and in his turn, Jacques Derrida, who sets out from Malamud to relaunch the marvelous mystery of congenital advance indebting. My duty is first to recognize my debts and complicities. For me, to find oneself human in humanity has been forever, before any knowledge and any reading, to find oneself a rather lame dog, mole, shrew, eagle, girl, lover, simultaneously, born at the same time, born several and several times. I had already died and been born more than once when I discovered, while making my way, other strollers, naturally poetic ones, who had already signed, countersigned, the books of the humanities of humanity. We are twice indebted, at least, or roughly, and rather more than that, as living human beings. First, that man, the human, is born as debt, according to Brahmanism, that humanity is originally indebted. I can attest to I was born indebted. Second, thereupon, since my birth, I've accumulated innumerable debts. I could make a list of them. It would be enormous. It would be incomplete. It would be indebted. It would be accompanied by a spectral following composed of all of the human and animal beings towards whom I have a debt, of which I have lost the trace. I owe debts to so many friends that I have never met in reality, although I encounter them constantly in other reality, since they live beside me on the shelves of my study. I could make a list of my textual debts that would please me. I love to be indebted. I love my debt. I love being forerun. I venerate my forerunners. I feel protected by their advance. I protect them. To be indebted is our wealth. I can live only from debts. I owe everything to my mother, but before I owe everything to my father. Debt has hold of me. I owe a life to nature. I owe a life to my daughter, to my son. One can have several total debts. Is it a matter of that culpa responsibility about which Jacques Derrida, to whom I owe more than one life, speaks in relation to that in advance owing, devance, which is also my human mortality or my mortal humanity? Schuld and should go before me. If I wish to say, no, I feel no culpa responsibility, I believe, Schuld would say to me, you cannot not. Attached to the light of the debt, there is always a slight and delicious shadow of culpability. Moreover, as Proust would say, it so happens that these two word cousins, Schuld the German and Schuld the English, speak from out of my two maternal languages, German, English, to my paternal language, French, going out in front of my ambitious French mind by correcting it in the careful voice of my internal mother. And thus I'm led and obliged to speak here of Rousseau, the most passionate, indebtified, the most culpa responsible, the most performatively human of men, as we should deposit in this chapter the whole of the Confessions and add to it all the rest of Rousseau's oeuvre, which is concerned with nothing but humanity. I find myself constrained by the limits of our session to recall only the musical key, the opening note, that will resonate later everywhere, like the bell with a rebounding ferruginous shrill and refreshing ring that announces to Marcel, the narrator of Proust, the beginning and the end of life and of the book, and that Maman is going to be able to come back from wherever she is, however far may be the past. I mean this volley of literature that is the preamble of the Confessions. You recall that incredible letter he sends on to the future, to us, raising himself up like a great revolutionary orator, where he implores the people who we are, in the name of my misfortunes and of all mankind, that is humanity, which he is all by himself and which we are into the bargain. L'humanité, c'est moi, he cries. L'humanité, c'est vous, he moans. Me, humanity, in all its truth. You, humanity, in all its cruelty. Let us unite at least once in order to preserve from annihilation a unique and useful work which will serve as a first piece of example for the study of men that has not yet begun. Literature for the time that neither you nor I will be living in any longer. A legacy to humanity which does not yet know what figure will have happened to it. A legacy of humanity. To humanity is left the monument of a single one called Rousseau, says Rousseau, but not disfigured, never yet depicted. For it is a very human trait of humanity to need to depict the figure of the present and to come, to make humanity come out of anticipation, to be preoccupied with a trace left behind oneself, to desire the end of being judged, weighed, certified human, like Stendhal wanted to be by Montesquieu. Have I been a man? As is fitting, as Jacques Derrida would say. Why do we read If This Was a Man by Primo Levi? Or yet again, why do we write it? Is it by philosophical vocation? So as to enter into a Talmudic conversation with Socrates or Levinas on the lessons of humanity? Is it to bear witness and to file complaint? Or else because nothing interests us more than evil and its histories, or history as the history of evil, and human life as the history of death? Here's what Primo Levi tells us in 1976. The need to recount was so urgent in us that I began to write this book over there, that is, in the camp. And even as I knew very well that I could not preserve those notes scribbled in secret that I would have to get rid of them right away because they would have cost me my life if they had been found on me. But I wrote this book as soon as I came back in the space of a couple of months. No, the point is not to testify. One knows too well when one is at Auschwitz that there will not be, there will never be justice. Everything happens beyond the reparable, beyond the forgivable, beyond the measurable. One knows that there is no response. But the notes are more precious than good and evil. But one cares for the story more than for oneself. It is the supreme good, the sovereign good. One cares for it more than life. It is the only thing that can be taken away from us. We are the proprietors of hell. The risk is that our own act of property will be torn away from us. The real hell would be to lose the book of hell, the picture of tortures, the work of art, the only certain monument not disfigured. Take my life, save my book, that is all of humankind. Oh, but humanity infinitely exceeds what men can imagine. Oh, but the picture surpasses the painter's suffering. Doing this, noting down in order to survive what could cost one survival, one is exactly at the last extremity. One would kill oneself in order to survive. But as we know, Primo Levi will have delayed the completion of the tragedy. Like all great books of cruelty, like the narratives of Shalamov, or that unique chef-d'oeuvre among all others, Le Sang du Ciel, The Blood of Heaven, by Ravitch, if this is a man is concerned to approach the impossible beyond of a sovereign cruelty, to remain at the pointed tip on the point of the impossible. Each time a new world of cruelty opens up, each time our souls gaping with surprise see before them the invention of a universe that is other and worse yet, because every worse theater wants to beat the current champion for inventions of cruelty, each time we are called to recognize the power and the cult of evil for the sake of evil, each time the diabolical seeks to revoke the torture victim's human credentials, there rise up poets of cruelty, bards of blood and ashes, who come forward to take up the challenge of radical evil by making themselves the thinkers and sayers of the unthinkable. There will always be artists of hell to write, paint, film, sing, respond to the flames with a larger fire. They triumph over hell by naming it, name by name. The work of a titan seer and blind seer like Milton that always ends tragically. The victor, and there are victors, does not survive his own triumph for long, and he knows it. He asks the gods or destiny for a reprieve, just the time to have written the book. If not, then at least the time to gather the names and the notes of the great apocalyptic register. If not, then at least the time to go back down within himself so as to take the human at its root and suffering at its seed and to glimpse from the humus, from the lowest point, the enormity of this humanity that can do and cause itself so much harm and take so much pleasure and so much suffering. Overcome by terror, he sees beyond, and he writes what he cannot say. He has seen. What is intolerable to see is carried off by the forgetfulness that kills everything in order to assure the humdrum of our daily life. The fact remains that he has had his vision. Once the terror has subsided, the seer quickly sketches the remnants, the contours of the remains. And it is by the crushing immensity of the remains that we can project the immeasurable measure of the vision that was seen, that one never sees in the present, that is always déjà vu. One remembers the last shrieks of terror of Proust's Temps Retrouvé, of that precipitous race over the last pages, of that hallucinated step of a man who runs away, terrified, who stammers, and repeats constantly, I'm afraid, I saw, I'm afraid, who is suffocating, who succumbs beneath the enormity of the task assigned to him, who swears that he will draw humanity before he dies, who is awaiting death, who runs out ahead of it, who casts forth his last prophetic breaths to warn us, the one who long ago, at the beginning of the search, was the sleeping man, is terribly awake. He now sees coming toward him the end of man, which is almost as prohibited as looking God in the face. He dies from it. Moreover, he has always been a dead man who has not yet taken up his post. Now he takes up his post. His state of anguish of the seer surpasses not only the sayer, but obviously the reader. We see the text swirl, whistling around our heads like a meteor, and most often we close our eyes so as not to be there when the end bursts. We have our eyes closed. Perhaps that is the terrible trait of humanity that we have such great difficulty recognizing. We prefer not to see. What is it? What makes man? What makes for the fact that not only man is a wolf for other men, but that for himself he's a jackal? We are the docile servants of destruction. The more brutal and cruel it is, the more we bow down. We do not want anything to do with ourselves. We cannot bear the sight of ourselves. We train ourselves. We are athletes of passivity, champions of what Proust calls habit. After a little while, with eyes wide open, we do not see what we see. Out of indolence and cowardice, says Kafka, we do not return to paradise. Cowardice, our second nature. It is understandable. It is exhausting to see daily cruelty. But for those I would call the knights of humanity, it is exhausting to see every day the cowardice of those who do not want to see the cruel face of humanity. How strong cowardice is. This spineless one is stronger than we are, and it begins so early. You remember little Rousseau accusing Marion, the good, sweet child, his fellow, but better than he, of the theft committed by himself and condemning her to death. It was stronger than he was. He could not do otherwise. And this little boy who plays in the ruins of Proust, a very clever child, is 7 years old, perhaps 8, and he knows everything in advance, without preceding knowledge, that is but divination, without knowledge, sublime and implacable super knowledge, which can be bestowed only on a child. He is the incorruptible judge of himself and those near to him, and he enters into humanity by a crime against humanity that is on the scale of his means. He will never forget his crime. He will commemorate it to his last line. No, it is not totem and taboo that I am starting over. It is before, and it is worse. The little one kills. It is his grandmother, who is his most maternal mother, who adores him, whom he adores, and whom he repudiates, whom he sends away to nothingness, whom he abandons. He's not even a matricide. He's lower. He's complicit in the execution by cowardice. Cowardice, the internal temptation. It is so universal, and how it protects itself. We barely speak of it. We write of it very little, because we are so hostage and ashamed. It is the supreme vice, the most widely shared. Cruelty without the excuse of hatred. Here's the scene. My grandmother left, sad, discouraged, and yet smiling, for she had such a humble heart and was so gentle that her tenderness for others and the little fuss she made about herself and her suffering were reconciled in her gaze with a smile where, contrary to what one sees in the faces of many human beings, there was no irony. And for all of us, something like a kiss of her eyes that could not see those she cherished without passionately embracing them with her gaze. The torture that my great aunt inflicted on her, the spectacle of my grandmother's vain prayers and her weakness, conquered in advance, trying uselessly to take the glass of liqueur away from my grandfather, was one of those things that one becomes habituated to seeing later, to the point of regarding them with a laugh, and of taking the side of the persecutor resolutely and gaily enough to convince oneself that it is not a matter of persecution. At that time, they caused me to feel such a horror that I would have liked to strike my great aunt. Already a man by my cowardice, I did what we all do once we are grown up, when faced with suffering and injustice. I did not want to see them. Now, this scene is the most important cause, let us say, of a determination of the subject's death. Likewise, of our death, we cannot bear the violence of life unless, in front of our anguish at the sight of the abysses of the human heart, is interposed to the beautiful earthly face, the face of maternal compassions. It is good and right that Proust did not single out for maternal face the face of his mother, but that of his grandmother. This reminds us that the point is not to take refuge in the ideological, biological mother. The face that saves is that of the smile, the one that opens, welcomes, does not accuse, gives us approval. Thus, the face can be that of a grandfather, for instance, for Thomas Bernhard, of a sister, Chateaubriand, or of Maman Varens, for Rousseau. For the glass workers of Carmaux, it was perhaps the beautiful face of Jaurès. It is the one that becomes earth for our soul's lips. We need to kiss, that is the mystery. The earth is Mama's cheeks. We touch them and we take courage again. We touch them with our lips, that is, we sublimate our cannibalism. We do not eat Maman's flesh, but we bring to our mouth the proof that her body exists for ours, that there is at least one being in this incomprehensible world who continues us, who shares the pain with us. The child in us wants his or her mother's kisses. This may seem neurotic to those who have chased off the internal child, and yet we want this kiss of peace, the alliance with the cheek, the host, the viaticum, the magic ring, perfect succor. Only sure thing, says the artist Joyce, amor matrice, flesh and earth. Myself, I find new strength every evening from my mother. As I find new life from my beloved foremother, I kiss my mother on the right cheek, her left cheek having become unusable, and I am kissed. My mother is chaste and does not really know how to kiss. At 99 years old, she still has her shyness. So, in place of embracing, she laughs very loud. And naive and good, like Proust's grandmother, she promises me not to grow old, so as still to be of use to me in resisting the frightening world. Man is perhaps promising, but he's first of all receiver of promises. I try to imagine who provided the maternal kiss to Jaurès. What beautiful face was the secret of his strength? I don't know. One dawning day of this past July at 5 a.m, I heard my mother weeping, complaining, lamenting to the heavens, like Job reduced to infancy, someone who is in despair. Myself, I was crying. I went down the flight of stairs, thrown headlong to help, while there rose up something like the very voice of humanity. Below sat my mother, calm, protected from the supplication by her deafness. The lamentation was from a yellow cat at bay in the kitchen, surrounded by my two cats, and who was begging for hospitality. But I heard it well, and I was not mistaken. It was with the voice of ageless humanity that the cat was calling, "Mama! Oh my God, Mama, help!" he cried with his whole soul similar to mine. And I felt the same pain as if I were his mother, the mother of a besieged living being. Fortunately, I was able to save him. In the kitchen, I smiled at him, and right away he ceased sobbing. In the morning, when my beloved calls to start the world anew, I burst out laughing, and he sighs, If you did not greet me with laughter, I would die from terror. Now I'm going to tell you how and why two persons who were able to resist giving it to death at Auschwitz one day found themselves bereft and delivered over to the horror of life long after having crossed the Acheron. I'm thinking of Primo Levi and Piotr Ravitch, men of exactly the same age, apart from that completely different, equally great in creation, poets and wise men. Piotr Ravitch was my friend. He taught me everything about life in death that makes for literature, but I have never been his mother. The one who took the place of the mother for him was Anna, the woman he had married upon leaving Auschwitz. How strong Anna was. There were many other women who passed through Piotr's history, all differently kind, but it was Anna who was charged with the kiss of humanity. In 1944 at Auschwitz, where one and the other were circumventing death, Piotr Ravitch and Primo Levi did not meet. They never met. They had many things in common and a number of things that separated them. One took the path of poverty. He wrote, for one needed to recount, one single immense book, for he was a knight of destitution. All the rest remained forever in an old drawer. The other, Primo Levi, wrote and spoke a lot, for no book could ever be for him the only book, and exhaust his need to recount, to offer his hand, or hold out his hand for someone to hold it. He too, like Piotr, wrote with the face of his mother held before him to protect his face from the bite marks of inhumanity. But one day, in May 1982, I hear Piotr weeping on the telephone like the yellow cat. Anna was going away. A brain tumor carried her very quickly. It is then that I understood she had been the face of l'humanité for Piotr. For the first time, he told me, he saw Auschwitz again, but he said it was worse. He no longer had the defenses and the time and the anger. And when one morning he lost the face, he gave himself up to death. It was the 21st of May, I was not there. Before that, I had not known that he survived only in the debt and under the gaze of Anna, owing himself to her and holding himself up shakily by Anna's hand. When he had no more debt, he was naked like Job, and he went away. Understand me, Anna was not love, but the face of the mother. It was not for being born and not dying. And consequently, it was for being born and not dying, and consequently for being able to enjoy loving other tender lovers without sinking into the undeniable hell. Later, I will see Primo Levi, likewise deprived of the face that keeps horror at a little distance, give himself up to the angels by his own will. In the case of Primo Levi, the beautiful face was that of his natural mother, whom fatal illness had painted with the muscle man mask of Auschwitz. Without a mother, one can no longer give daily birth to oneself. Both of them, these so very different seers, were in their lifetimes dead men who had not yet taken up their posts, who remained at their human posts only through solidarity with the people of mortals, but on the condition of being re-pulled back from nothingness day after day and nourished with that milk that is the humanity of humanity, the milk of human kindness. Every day, I give my mother life, my mother who moreover was named Life at her birth, flowers to read and books to look at. No, I didn't not commit a lapsus. It is that thus I give myself a scene called Reading of My Mother. At this stage, very, very high, close to the summit of time, when I is going to be 100 years old, marvelous and slight changes happen in all the features of the figure of human life. I say that as the laboratory researcher I have become. From a lower station, I observe the very strong and unknown being who goes before me. I read my mother with curiosity, microscope, telescope, she's very close, so far, planet. To tell the truth, I do not understand her absolute agreement with living. An agreement, a pact, body to body, an effortless swimming. She feels herself closer and closer to the cats that in former days she packed outside of her own kind. I give her books. Instinctively, all those that come to me for her are books of the last extremity, but which end well for the moment. To every narrative, she asks the question of reality, testimony of fiction. I ask myself a question as well. Is not reality a fiction? Fiction a reality? And we, the interpreters and authors of everything that comes about? I notice this year that my mother no longer reads as I would read page by page. She reads otherwise. In truth, she looks at the book. She contemplates the geraniums. There is a close relation between the lines of the book and the groupings of the flowers. To contemplate mobilizes her whole philosophy. There is the book. She studies the portrait of the world sensually. She inhales faces. Human life, in the end, is that. Books, everything is book, everything is mystery, everything is resurrection. One must clean up the geraniums, remove the dead flowers, turn the pages of the book. An old woman who looks for a long time at the figure of the book, that is the milk of humanity.